This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutan, and on The Breakfast Grill with me today is veteran journalist and businessman Kalimullah Hassan. He is chairman of the ECM Libra Financial Group Berhad and a director of Singapore-listed UPP Limited. Datisri headed the national news agency Bernama for 16 months before becoming editor-in-chief of the New Straits Times Press Berhad during the administration of Abdullah Ahmad Badawi. He's just launched a collection of columns and speeches titled The Malaysia That Could Be. Welcome to BFM. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Kali, if I might call you that, the postscripts in your book are extraordinary. They make up a small part of this large collection, but they're very striking in what you take on in them. And I would like to begin with some of the strong positions you've taken. Now, coming for much criticism in your postscripts, two of them there is, of course, the current Prime Minister, Najib Razak. And you say, and I quote you here, he says, "It was in these post-Abdullah years that I started having grave doubts about Najib. I knew he was not a strong character, but I thought all these years in politics had taught him something. Unfortunately, you either have it or you don't." Very strong position on the Prime Minister. What accounts for your feelings, those strong feelings towards him?
Well, I think that when he became Prime Minister after Abdullah stepped down, expectations were very high that he would rectify a lot of the things or carry out the reforms that Abdullah had promised and didn't carry out. Unfortunately, he had a small window, and not only did he not use that window, but things got progressively worse. I think if you can look at what happened to the restrictions on the media, the closing down of the Edge, the blocking of the news portals. That's only one aspect of it. But I think generally it's quite embarrassing because wherever we go, I travel quite a bit. And as a Malaysian, people always ask you questions about the money deposited into the Prime Minister's account, about 1MDB, about the general state of decay in Malaysia. And I'm really disappointed in him.
But okay, let's talk about the question of his character. You're saying he's not a strong character, and I know this is sometimes said of him, but hasn't he shown in recent times his ability to get his party to rally around him? In fact, he's got apparently the wholehearted support of Khairi Jamaluddin, Abdullah's son-in-law. He's removed his deputy without tearing UMNO apart, apparently. He's weathered, as you noted just now, weathered some of the worst press headlines of any Malaysian prime minister in living memory internationally. And he's dealt with 1MDB and the controversy around it by, you know, removing the Attorney General, elevating members of the Public Accounts Committee into cabinet, and therefore, you know, stymieing the discussion and the exploration that was happening in Parliament. I mean, he's done some extraordinary things. Shows, I mean, whether you like it or not, it shows a man who seems to know what he wants, which is to stay in power, perhaps.
Yeah, well, that I think you have to give it to him. I think in order to stay in power, he has done all the things that you wouldn't have expected him to do. But I think I was talking more about morality, about ethics, when I talk about character. I was not talking about the ability to stay in power. Ability to stay in power, a lot of you can see in the third world countries, in the African countries, how people like Idi Amin or Mugabe and Muammar Gaddafi, how they have the, does that make them people of strong character?
Well, okay, this is interesting. I believe the High Commissioner to Britain, Malaysia's High Commissioner to Britain, wrote to the Financial Times, you know, in defending Najib Razak's record, saying that to call him a disastrous Prime Minister would be incorrect. He's done a lot of good things, according to the High Commissioner. He lists a series of successes. And is it fair, I mean, to ignore this? I mean, do you think that in your assessment you're ignoring potentially some of his successes?
Well, let me ask you one question. I say, are you proud to be a Malaysian today?
Well, I think, to be fair, I think there is some embarrassment and some self-loathing, perhaps. But I haven't written a book yet. And, you know, I think it's also, okay, let's come back to the question of Najib defying your expectations. Why is he so strong today? What do you attribute it to?
I thought the interview was about the book.
Yeah, and it's because it's part of part of your book, right? I mean, the postscript really speaks quite a bit about Najib. He says you talk about One Malaysia, and you say that much that happened in 2015 showed that Najib lacked a commitment to his own idea of One Malaysia.
Yes, well, I think. The Prime Minister, the current Prime Minister, has got his finger on the UMNO pulse. He knows how to keep them in line. A friend of mine was telling me about this book by Michael Sandel. I haven't read the book, but it talks about an utopian village. I think it's called Amalas. And in this village, everybody is happy. Parents get along very well with the children. Children get along with everyone. But eventually, they find out that the reason why they are happy is because they have imprisoned a child underground. And that child, if they release him, then all the unhappiness and everything will come in. Now, the question was, how many of them had the moral the belief in right and wrong to walk away from that village and to encounter unhappiness? Not many people did, I think. I'll have to read the book, but this is basically what my friend described to me. Now, the question comes back to UMNO. So a lot of these people know that a lot of things are wrong, but they benefit a lot from the patronage and the largesse which is handed out by UMNO. And that's been the way. I wouldn't say it's under Najib. It was also the same under Abdullah, much lesser extent, and also under Mahathir. So they see all the wrongs that are being done, but it's of personal benefit to them. They don't walk away. So the Prime Minister knows how to play that very well. And that's how he keeps them in line. And that's how he's staying in power.
Is it real politic, Malaysia style? I mean, can we expect anything more from our politicians?
Unfortunately, I think on both sides of the spectrum, I don't hold out much hope.
Kali, can I ask you, are you a member of UMNO?
No, I'm not.
Were you never a member of UMNO?
I was a member when I was working with Tun Gafababa as the press secretary. And Tajul Rosli, who was the Menteri Besar of Perak, came to the office and got me to fill up the form. I've never paid a cent in dues. So I've never attended a single meeting. So I don't think I'm a member of UMNO today.
You've made extraordinary statements in your postscript. And, you know, I imagine some detractors, you know, people who maybe have something against you or people who support the Prime Minister might consider you an angry and bitter man, angry and bitter about the unceremonious fall of Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, who you, in your book, firmly believe in. You notice shortcomings, but you say this was a man, and I think the word is, with strength of character and belief in the democratic process. Is that fair? I mean, is this coming merely from a place of hurt and bitterness?
I don't think so. If you read the book, I was among the first to speak to Abdullah to ask him to step down. Even way before he decided to step down, I went to see him shortly after the 2008 elections and said, "Sir, I think you have to go. I think it's untenable for you to stay." And if I recollect, he was quite unhappy about it. But subsequently, I think more and more of his friends and aides told him the same thing. I think it was about 3-4 months after I told him that my view was that he should step down, that he stepped down. So if I wanted him to stay in power, I would have asked him to fight all the way, like some of them did.
Do you regret not advising him to fight?
I've apologized to him for asking him to step down because I thought that the alternative would have been better. But honestly, I think he had his chance, and he's still my friend. I saw him a few days ago, but I think he floundered. He failed us.
Now, you say, and I quote from the book, the early months of Abdullah's administration, you call the most propitious and promising political period that the country has seen in more than three decades. Do you think we'll ever see that again?
Unlikely. I think unlikely. Not in the near future. Probably not in my lifetime.
Why has Abdullah taken the position of advisor patronus? Is he reconciled to that time? And clearly the prime minister was part of that move against him.
I don't know why he did it. But the position of patronus advisor always goes to ex-prime ministers to allow them
a sinecure. Payment for good things done. No.
Well, it's not much. I think in monetary terms, I think it's probably about 10,000-15,000 ringgit. So it doesn't keep them in the lifestyle that they are used to as prime ministers. But it allows them to use the perks, the office, to keep the office. So I don't think it's the money.
I'm speaking to veteran journalist and businessman Kalimullah Hassan, former editor-in-chief of the New Straits Times Press Berhad and deputy chairman of the group till late 2008. And next up, we talk more about UMNO. It's also about the media, its immediate past and its future. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, if you just joined us, I'm speaking to veteran journalist and businessman Kalimullah Hassan, former editor-in-chief of the New Straits Times Press Berhad. He's just launched a collection of columns and speeches titled The Malaysia That Could Be. There's a bit of a lament in that title. I think it really depends on how your cast of mind. But let's just to finish up our discussion of UMNO, you say some extraordinary things in documenting the 2008 general election and its aftermath. And you almost seem to suggest there were people in UMNO that were, pushing for strategies that you consider undemocratic, buying people over, elected officials, causing trouble. Now, causing trouble, you kind of don't quite pin it down. Did Abdullah save Malaysia from a politically orchestrated racial conflict? Is that what you're trying to suggest? Were there people in UMNO pushing for that?
Yeah, there were. There were people in UMNO who were very emotional. They couldn't take a lot of the, I think it happened in 2013 as well. When Barisan did even worse, and I'm sure Najib handled it probably the same way as Abdullah did. But they're not used to defeat. They're not used to losing.
Is it because they think that UMNO, the party, and the state are one and the same? You list, quite interesting institutions that give feedback to UMNO in the run-up to the general elections. You mentioned KEMAS, the Special Branch, Military Intelligence, Bureau Tata Negara. Is that their responsibility? Or have our state institutions been commandeered by the party to keep it in power?
Yeah, I think they have been commandeered by the party to keep it in power, and they have been abused. I never liked the way they were doing it even in those days. And they think that it's their religious, if you want to put it that way, religious duty or right to maintain UMNO in power. It's a warped mindset.
Is there any hope for UMNO? Are there any good guys in UMNO, in your view?
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are, but I think they are dwarfed or they are pummeled into submission by the louder ones. There are a lot of good people in UMNO, but the loud ones, are the ones who always get their way.
You say that in your postscript that the right wing, that Abdullah didn't censure the right wing enough when it, did this race baiting, when we talk about the cowhead issue and stuff. Why do you think he could not, in fact, maintain the discipline, keep them on message?
It's a question I think I've asked myself 1,000 times. I really don't know, but one of the things that I think happened was that because I always maintained that the group of advisors around him, the majority of them, the so-called fourth floor boys, were actually very intelligent, sober, good people. who gave him good advice, but the attacks from Dr. Mahathir and his people made them look like, you know, a bunch of corrupt, self-serving people. So much so that Abdullah started distancing himself from them. I mean, there were instances when he didn't speak for to them for weeks. He didn't have meetings with them for weeks because he was he thought that he should listen more to his UMNO guys. And his UMNO guys, the ones that I think I've mentioned in my book, most of them were self-serving people and they didn't give him the right advice. So in that sense, he got detached and he allowed a lot of these things to happen, like, you know, the demolition of the temple on Deepavali Day by Kirtoyo. He should have come down hard on that guy, but it was a very muted response. And it was things like that which allowed things to just deteriorate and get worse and worse.
You have suggested that he was ill-advised, and you just said that he seemed to be affected by, you know, criticisms of him. Is that in some ways a personal failure, a failure of character, that he didn't believe enough in what he was hearing from the fourth floor? I mean, if you like to call it the fourth floor.
Yeah, he's my friend, and I don't like to say things about... I think... you know, sometimes I think that he was a prime minister who should not have been, unfortunately.
Well, moving on, you also touch on the question of media. And because you're a media man and it's clear that your postscript has been written very recently because it's really up to date. And you try to dispel the much-rumoured suggestion that you were behind the Malaysian Insider. You say that very strongly. You give reasons. But recently, after the closure, there's been rumours again that maybe you are trying to revive the Insider along with Brendan Pereira, who you worked with at the New Straits Times. For the record, are you planning to revive the Malaysian Insider?
Not at all. I'll never get involved in the media business. I was never involved in Insider. And I mean, I sympathise with what's happened to them. I sympathise with Jahbar and Brendan. But it's a business that... unless you have political ambition, you shouldn't get involved with it. It's certainly not a business where you go and make money. So I'm not interested and I'm not involved.
Now, I'm going to quote you here. You say, in 2013, Najib asked Tong Kwee Ong to meet him and suggested that Tong buy over the Insider. That's quite an interesting statement to make, considering that now we see Tong Kwee Ong, who owns The Edge, as being some of a out of an antagonist towards the Prime Minister, and Pooja has not been happy with The Edge. We see that in all kinds of actions against The Edge. What was the occasion for this meeting of minds? I mean, were they friends then?
Yeah, I mean, Tong is a businessman. He's friends with everyone. And he was asked, this is what he related to me. Tong is my partner and a longtime friend. He was asked to see the Prime Minister at his house. It was quite late at night, close to midnight, and the Prime Minister told him, he said, the Insider is a thorn in my side, and why don't you buy it over? And so that's what happened.
Okay, so the idea is that, and here the dynamics is, you buy over a hostile media organization, or you get a friendly organization to buy it over. Would that be the process?
Well, I would suppose so. I think that's how they think.
Yeah, so do you understand or know what caused the rift between Tong, if there is an apparent rift between Tong and Najib? Was it a failed promise of a newspaper license?
No, I think in Tong's case, he's a businessman. And I've known him for, close to 25, 26 years. Quite a fair guy. I think what got him into trouble was the focus on the 1MDB, all the articles that The Edge was writing and... stuff like that. So I think that essentially made a lot of people in the PMO very unhappy with him. And I think that's where they ran foul of each other.
But why? I mean, we can't be naive about this. In choosing to take that editorial line, couldn't The Edge have anticipated that they were going to be in a headlong clash with Putrajaya?
That you'll have to ask the edge. I can't answer for them.
Okay. That is another point that you make in your story of the Malaysian Insider. You say that the businessman Vincent Chia was funding the Malaysian Insider.
Yeah.
And then you kind of tantalizingly stop at giving details. You say, well, that in fact, the funding from Vincent Chia had stopped and another businessman stepped in. And I quote you here, who certainly is controversial. And he took over the funding. And you say, I leave it to Leslie Lau, who is one of the partners at TMI, to say who it was. Can I ask you if you would tell us who that person is?
You work for the Insider. You should know.
I used to, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay, it was rumored that Joe Lowe was the person. Could you confirm that?
Well, you have to ask Leslie Lau. I'm not denying it, but you have to ask Leslie Lau.
Okay. Now, the other side of it, I'm going to move on maybe from one problematic dimension of the media to another, which is you relate some of the petty racism that happened in the News Straits Times. And I was quite shocked by it, you know, that had to do with promotions of Brendan Pereira for Hadev Kaur. I mean, what's going on there? Why that kind of petty racist response to promotions?
You know, it's really puzzled me that a newspaper could be like that. But I think it all happened after Nordin Sopi and Munir Majid left the New Straits Times. I think when they were there, they ran a pretty good ship. And then you had when Anwar and Daim and Mahathir were handling it, they put in the people who they thought would serve their interests. And these guys thought that UMNO would want them to basically promote the Bumiputras into all the senior positions. So when I went there, one of the first things I did was to ask Abdullah. I said, look, I got to get really good people. There are good people here. I need to promote them. And he says, no, you run it like a business organization. And that's how people like Hardev, and I think it's mentioned in my book, and Brandon got promoted. I'm not saying there were some really very good Bumiputras there. In fact, the guy who helped me convert it from broadsheet to tabloid, Salahuddin Osman, he did it within 3 months when the Times of London took something like a year or two to do it. They were so petty because they believed that since it's owned by UMNO, the Media Prima, the New Straits Times Group, that the only guy who should be at the top is a Bumiputra. And there's something that I didn't concur with. And that got
and
me.
Neither did Abdullah.
Yeah, neither did Abdullah, yeah. I mean, don't forget that he promoted Yong Soo Hyung, the first Chinese to be the editor-in-chief of Bernama, much against what Zainuddin Maidin, the information minister, was trying to do. You know, he said you can't have a Chinese as the editor-in-chief.
Interestingly enough, because you kind of try to work out the racial dynamics in your postscript, you say of yourself that you're Indian, and you also add Dr. Mahathir and Zainuddin Maidin as Indians too,
yeah.
Which I think they might take some objection to.
Look, you know, I can't run away from what I am. If they want to run away from what they are, that's their problem, not mine.
Are we trapped as Malaysians in this racial mindset? Is there any possibility? Is it strong leadership, like Abdullah provided? I'm taking what you say at face value, that because he set the tone, it opened possibilities. Is that what we need? Is that all we're lacking?
Yes, I think we need really strong leadership to get us back on the right path. And as long as the leadership uses race, religion and stuff like that to stay on in power, then I think we're headed towards being a failed state.
That's a very strong statement, right? Do you think that's overstated, that Malaysia, on many indices is still doing well? I mean, the currency has got to stabilize, and with maybe the stabilization, the petrol, that, you know, that there's no possibility. And our geopolitical situation, we are not control one half of the Straits of Malacca. Which superpower will allow us to be a failed state? What do you mean by a failed state?
You know, I would recommend a book to you. It's called Zimbabwe by a guy called Philip Barclay. And if you read that book about how Zimbabwe, from being the maize bowl of Africa when Mugabe took over in 1981, and how it was doing very well until 87, 88, and from then it just went downhill, you will see a lot of shades of Malaysia in that book. And, you know, history tells you that this is how failed state starts. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a period of time. And we are, I think we are halfway there. I'm very pessimistic. I hope I'm wrong.
And who would you blame? Do you blame the current Prime Minister or do you blame Dr. Mahathir?
I think it is a succession since from Mahathir's time it started, I think. And it's just gotten worse.
Is there any hope, Khali? Is there any hope for change, you know, drawing back from the tipping point?
I don't know. I hope there is.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I've been speaking to veteran journalist and businessman Kalimullah Hassan, former editor-in-chief of the New Straits Times Press Berhad, about his book, The Malaysia That Could Be. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.